Good evening, and welcome to Health Matters. I'm Dr. Sanford Katz, and I'll be your host this evening. Our topic is skin cancer and sun protection. We'll also talk about other types of skin problems and skin care, including sun-damaged skin. Joining me in the studio this evening is dermatologist Dr. Sarah Glorioso with Arklatex Dermatology. Welcome to Health Matters.
Thank you.
You can join in our discussion this evening at 1-800-552-8502. Dr. Glorioso, as a dermatologist, you are an expert at the skin. Please share with our listeners your training and what it takes to become a dermatologist.
Dermatology is a specialty after medical school. You do your 4 years of medical school, and then you do an intern year, most commonly done in internal medicine. And then dermatologists do 3 years, which focuses just on skin. There are some subspecialties after dermatology that you can do, a Mohs surgery fellowship or a dermatopathology fellowship, which would be a year following.
Okay, Mohs doesn't have anything to do with the Three Stooges, I imagine.
No, it doesn't. Mohs was named for a doctor named Dr. Mohs, M-O-H-S, and it's a special way to cut skin cancer, look at it under the microscope immediately following the procedure, and then sew the patient up if the skin cancer was gotten, or if we didn't get all the margins, then you take more layers and then sew after that.
Got it. Okay. Well, as we get into talking about skin cancer, I was doing some research and was not entirely surprised as a cancer doctor, but did want to note that skin cancer is in fact the most common cancer in the United States, and the estimates are that 1 in 5 Americans will develop skin cancer at some point in their life. Estimates are also that about 5.4 million cases of non-melanoma, that's not the melanoma that we think of, but the non-melanoma, the basal cells and the squamous cells, will be diagnosed in about almost 3.5 million people in the United States in this year, I guess, right? And interestingly, it seems as though both of these forms of cancer, the basal cell and the squamous cell, the non-melanoma cancers, are increasing overall, and particularly in people under the age of 40. So it always seems like skin cancer is a disease of the older or the elderly, but it seems that it's growing, particularly in the younger population. Do you find that in your practice?
Yes, I do. Especially, in tanning bed users and young women where their back is immediately touching the tanning bed, we see a lot of basal cells, back and chest. Young men who are outdoor workers or have a lot of fishing hobbies, golf, that aren't wearing sun protection, we do see a lot of basals and squames in a younger population than you generally think of basal cell and squamous cell. Of course, when we see a melanoma in a young person, you really take that seriously.
So we're using these terms, basal cell and squamous cell and melanoma, and they're all skin cancers. What is the difference between them?
So basal cell is by far the most common type we see, and it's one of those that, it's a non-healing, pearly-looking papule, and they're named for the cell that they come from, so the basal cell, whereas a squamous cell is the second most aggressive type of skin cancer that we see, and it's named for the cell is called a squamous cell, and it's typically in sun-exposed areas, a rough, red, scaly-looking lesion, whereas melanoma comes from a melanocyte.
That's the pigmented cell.
That's the dark pigmented cell, and that's why it typically is a darker looking lesion, but you can rarely have an amelanotic melanoma, which is not common, where it's not pigmented. But by far and away, those are the darker lesions.
And the melanoma is the more serious one, the more life-threatening.
Absolutely. Melanoma can be deadly. If we catch it early, it has very good cure rates, but melanoma can be deadly, and it's by far the most serious form of skin cancer.
Okay, now can the other forms of skin cancer, basal cell and squamous cell, can they also be life-threatening?
Basal cell, very, very rarely. However, squamous cell can, as it can get into the nerve, the lymph node, and you can die of squamous cell as well. It can metastasize. Again, if those are caught early, very, very treatable. So that's why, good detection, skin checks are recommended.
I see. So why do you think that the incidence is rising in the younger population?
I think the intermittent sun exposure, you know, that there's been numerous, you know, a lot of research that shows just intermittent burns frequently. Soldiers, there's been a lot of data by the military that just shows that people are not using that sun protection. Plus, I think, you know, there's with pollution, things like that, the UV index is higher in a lot of cities. There's a lot of reasons.
Ultraviolet light exposure is what you're saying.
Yes.
Okay.
Maybe increasing. And even though we try to preach about sunscreen and sun protection, it's just some people just don't take it seriously.
I see. I was looking on the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control statistics, and it looks like in the South, in particular Texas and Louisiana, that we have some of the highest rates of skin cancer in the country and also the highest rates of skin cancer-related mortality in the country. Is that have to do with the fact that we're closer to the equator? Does it have to do with lifestyle? Or what do you think is playing into that?
Right. So we are closer to the equator. Our sun obviously is brighter here, but a lot of, outdoor workers, a lot of outdoor activities, hobbies, those sorts of things. And then, you know, people not seeking health, you know, seeking physician help early. I think that's a problem in the South, not only in skin cancer, but a lot of other medical problems, that people wait to go to the doctor a little longer.
Okay. So you mentioned sun and UV or ultraviolet light exposure. So I guess I should ask you, what brand of tanning bed do you recommend?
I guess that's a joke. Yeah, so dermatologists vehemently do not like tanning beds at all. Very rarely, we do prescribe narrowband UVB for skin diseases like psoriasis, but no dermatologist likes any brand of tanning beds.
Okay, now the reason I ask that question is that, you know, you see advertisements where some of the tanning salons will state that certain claims as though their bulbs are healthier or safer, or is there anything to that?
That we do not believe that there is any safe tanning bed.
Okay.
Except in a controlled environment for certain skin diseases. Spray tan is absolutely safe. Mm-hmm. The self-tanners that you can apply at home, we consider that safe, but no, we do not advocate tanning beds.
Okay, thank you. So you mentioned about lifestyle and also about occupation, working outdoors. One statistics I found that was interesting was that before the age of 50, that the incidence of melanoma were higher in women than in men, but by age 60, the rates are twice as high in men than in women. Can you explain why that might be? Does it have to do with tanning and tanning beds, or I would assume that women don't have aren't as likely to have the outdoor jobs that men do.
Right. So I think in the younger population, it's the females going to the tanning beds. Men do not go to the tanning bed as often as young females do, and then of course the most common age group is the older Caucasian males have the highest incidence of melanoma. And I think a lot of that is accumulation of sun exposure over their lifetime and then later detection. They're not getting their skin checked as frequently as the younger females or females in general. We do way more skin checks in females than in males.
Okay, and that's just because women tend to go to the doctor more than...
Correct, yeah. Yes.
Okay, well, staying on that topic, so what you talk about skin checks. What are some of the warning signs that people should look out for that would prompt them to go to the doctor to have a mole or skin lesion evaluated?
A lesion that is bleeding or not acting like any of their other lesions, or we call it the ugly duckling sign in regards to melanoma. A mole that looks different than the other moles, or a new mole. The ABCDEs, of course, are what we preach in our office. A being an asymmetric lesion.
What does that mean, asymmetric?
So one side's light, one side's dark. An irregular border is B. So the edges look jagged maybe, and it's not a nice circle or oval. C is a lot of color variation, red, blue, black, brown, a lot of difference in color. D is a large diameter, so we say 6 millimeters or above. That's bigger than about a pencil head eraser. And then E is a lesion that evolves quickly. So something that comes up. A lot of melanomas are seen in pre-existing moles, mm-hmm. or you can have one out of the blue.
I see. So if someone has some concerns, do they would they go to their primary care physician? Would they go straight to the dermatologist?
Either way, you know, dermatologists, of course, are trained to look and do biopsies right away. So if you can get into the dermatologist, I think that would be ideal. But a lot of family practitioners and internists and pediatricians can often tell you whether a lesion looks concerning to them and then can field you on to the dermatologist.
I see. Now, are there certain people who are at greater risk who should have screening more frequently?
Yeah, again, the outdoor workers, or if there's any sort of like arsenic exposure, things like that for squamous cell, history of that. Of course, any patient who's immunosuppressed, transplant patients, for example, need to be seen more frequently. Patients with history of bad burns, of course, a family history. Anybody who's already had a skin cancer is way more likely to get a skin cancer again. Fair-skinned individuals, more likely than dark skin. However, we do see skin cancer in dark skinned patients. So those would all be risk factors.
Okay. Now, you mentioned screening. Are there recommendations for regular skin screening, and who's supposed to get regular skin screening at what point in their life and how often?
So the American Academy of Dermatology likes a yearly skin cancer check. That may not be as practical for everybody, you know, starting at about the age of 30, if you can have a total body skin check. And then the dermatologist can tell you whether or not they think it's necessary yearly or every 6 months. Obviously, once someone has had an atypical mole or has a lot of moles or has had a skin cancer or precancer, then the dermatologist would recommend that you're seen more frequently depending on what your diagnosis is. But I think a baseline skin cancer screening at, you know, about age 30, and then you can kind of go from there.
Mm-hmm. And now what if you have an irregular mole, let's say something called a dysplastic nevus or an abnormal pigmented lesion. Does that predispose you to developing melanoma? Should that prompt you to get screened more frequently?
Yes. So atypical moles are not skin cancers, but they do mean that you have a higher chance of getting a melanoma in your life than someone who hasn't had one. It also means that those atypical moles could potentially turn into melanoma. And so if you've had one of those, you absolutely need a yearly skin check. And depending on how many you've had, the dermatologist may say every 6 months, but at least yearly if you've had an atypical mole.
I see. I want to invite our listeners to call in with their questions for Dr. Glorioso at 1-800-552-8502. This is a community program, and we welcome your participation. Now, what about different skin types? Are there some people who need to be, you know, more diligent or more careful with the sun than other people?
Yeah, so, you know, fair-skinned, light-eyed individuals, light hair, need to apply sunscreen, you know, every couple of hours, every 2 hours is what we say, and reapply. We still recommend, you know, sunscreen in what we call darker Fitzpatrick types. Those are, you know, people of higher, more pigment, but they may not have to be as diligent about reapplying.
I see. And is there a, you know, we keep talking about limiting sun exposure and sunscreen.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a safe amount of sun exposure for somebody, or does it depend on their skin type?
You know, they say 15 minutes with having your extremities open is probably safe. I still always recommend sunscreen on the face every single day, so that you, because that area is the area that's always exposed for the most part. You know, a little bit of sun is okay to get, you know, some vitamin D in, but you certainly don't need as much as most people are getting. And most people, studies show, don't apply enough sunscreen and don't reapply often enough.
Okay, so let's talk about it a little bit. What makes a good sunscreen?
So I like a combination of physical and chemical blockers. So physical blockers are the old, like, zinc oxide, titanium dioxide. Back in the day, those were the lifeguards with the white, you know, stripes on their face. Well, those sunscreens are called physical blockers, and they protect from both the you know, UVB and UVA. So you have to look for the words broad spectrum to make sure you're covering ultraviolet A and ultraviolet B. And then a chemical sunscreen also that's, that has like oxybenzone, avobenzone. So if you can get one that's a combination, you know, you're getting a broad spectrum coverage. And I like at least an SPF of 30 or above.
And SPF stands for what?
Sun protection factor.
Okay. And that's what number?
30 or above.
30 or above. Now, you know, I've heard conflicting things that beyond a certain number that it doesn't really mean anything. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, there's a lot of dermatologists that also think probably at above 50 that, you know, if you have one that says 100 plus, you still need to reapply it. So there's been a push that at some point that they may just all say 50 plus. They don't have that yet. The FDA came out with some new sunscreen changes because there's no such thing as waterproof sunscreen. There's water resistant. And so they made some changes. But right now you can still buy the 100 plus. But what the biggest thing is we still want people to reapply every 90 minutes to a couple hours.
And so the ones that are sports sunscreen or still every 90 minutes regardless?
Oh, absolutely.
And what about if they say waterproof and you go into the water?
No. So yeah, it's not water. There's no waterproof. That just doesn't exist. So when you get out of the water, you really should reapply. Those sports sticks are good. I like the sticks for the faces, especially in little kids, because they always complain if you put the cream on their face, it burns their eyes. So if you can get one of those sports sticks, that is good for the face, but it still needs to be reapplied. And it's not sweat proof and it's not waterproof. That's just doesn't exist. They may be rider resistant for about 90 minutes.
I see. And what about for children and babies?
Okay. Yeah. So above, you know, the warning, the recommendations are at about 6 months, it's completely safe to use sunscreen in babies. Under that age, you want to try to keep them out of the sun as much as you can, and you should use wide brim hats or those little sun hats or keep them in the shade. A little bit of sunscreen is probably okay, but the American Pediatric Association recommends it at they're probably under 6 months that you not use as much sunscreen just because there are chemicals in the sunscreen.
You mentioned wide-brimmed hats, and I've seen a lot of women in particular wearing mm-hmm. these wide-brimmed hats, and I myself, I look terrible in hats. For those people who don't have the benefit of seeing what I look like, I don't look good in hats. But I have very fair skin, and so I have a tendency to burn my scalp, and it's hard to apply sunscreen to your scalp. So hats are very important. I know I always try to put hats on my kids. What about SPF clothing?
Love it. That's been one of the best things that's come out. You'll see the kids at the pool now with the rash guard. Those are the sun shirts that have sun protective clothing. And that makes it easier on the parent that they're not having to like reapply the sunscreen to their children. We, dermatologists love the long sleeve swim shirts. It just makes so much sense. So we're big fans of the sun protective clothing. And I advocate those every day to my patients.
Gotcha. And can you have an allergy to sunscreen?
You can.
Then what do you do?
You try to find one that just has those physical blockers. The titanium and zinc are much less likely to react than some of the others. And there are, it's a trial and error. But they're actually now sunscreens are some of them are in our patch testing because we've had so many patients have some sunscreen allergies. So. But there's generally one that everybody can find.
I see. So how much of your practice involves seeing people who have sun-related skin damage, whether it be just from years of exposure to precancerous lesions to actual skin cancer?
Probably about 40%, I would say. But between total body skin checks, mole checks, skin cancer, sun damage, pre-cancer. It's a huge, huge portion of my practice and probably every dermatologist's practice in this city.
I see. So once someone comes to you and they, in fact, have a suspicious-looking lesion, what's the process that you go through to evaluate it?
We We can use a dermatoscope, and that's a special light magnifier that we look at it with our eyes. But generally, my rule is if I have any index of suspicion, I do what's called a shave biopsy or sometimes a punch biopsy. And that's, we numb up the skin with a little local lidocaine. It's generally very well tolerated. And we take a small blade and do a biopsy and send it to the pathologist. In Shreveport, we have some very good dermatopathologists who check it under the microscope and let us know, and
so
we go from there.
So a biopsy is removal of the entire thing or a portion?
Depends. I typically try to get the whole top of the specimen so the pathologist can get a very good look. But it is not the treatment for the lesion. So it's not excising it and treating it, but I try to get as much of the lesion as I can, so then that way they can get a better look under the microscope.
And So basically you do the biopsy, you send it to a pathologist or a doctor who's trained to look at these things, and then you get more information and you go from there. Now, what about in cases where, let's say, they're scraped or burned and you don't have that information? How often does that occur? I know sometimes people will go and they'll have like scrapings or burnings of lesions, but not actually having a biopsy.
Yeah, so you can treat some skin cancers with what's called electrodesiccation and curettage, or EDNC, and those are used typically for the more superficial types of skin cancers or precancers, and that is effective treatment, not quite as effective as excision or Mohs surgery, for example, but that is an effective way to treat skin cancers. And then liquid nitrogen is often referred to as burning. It's actually kind of freezing because it's so cold. And we use that to treat mostly precancers, which are called actinic keratoses, and they're precancers to squamous cell skin cancers. And dermatologists use liquid nitrogen every day.
I see. Once again, I want to invite our listeners to call in with their questions for Dr. Glorioso. We are talking about skin cancer, skin conditions, and other various topics relating to the skin. So what parts of the body are most commonly affected?
So the head and neck, of course, with basal cell and squamous cell, because those are the areas that get most sun exposure. Of course, the backs of the hands, the backs of the arms get chronic sun exposure with wearing short sleeves. So by far and away, we probably do the majority of biopsies and skin cancer surgeries on the sun exposed areas. Now, melanoma can be a little different because it can occur after bad burns where people have them on their trunks. And so, you know, backs of the legs in women, because they'll lay on their belly on the beach and the backs of their legs is getting burnt. So melanoma is a little different, but basal cell and squamous cell, the two most common forms of skin cancer, are generally in the sun exposed areas.
I see. And what about dark-skinned individuals, African-American, people of African descent? Do they have to worry about sun exposure and skin cancer?
They do. Squamous cell we see in African-American women oftentimes on the legs, that they sitting by space heaters can sometimes trigger squamous cells. So we see those on the legs. And then acral lentiginous melanoma, which can be on the feet.
That's a mouthful, acral lentiginous.
Yeah, melanomas on the feet of African Americans can be bad, and they're often detected very late.
Does that affect the hands and the fingernails too?
Yes.
Okay, so it sounds like it's equal opportunity in infliction.
By far away, more skin cancer is more common in light skin, but we do see it in dark-skinned individuals.
Okay, so how do you know whether to do a biopsy, to do freezing, to do scraping and burning, or whether to do that Mohs procedure, which you mentioned earlier?
Typically, the severity of the lesion and the location. So in the central part of the face, especially the nose or around the eyes, around the lips, you want to, for an aggressive basal cell or squamous cell, you definitely want to get a Mohs surgeon involved, and probably a plastic surgeon or an oculoplastic surgeon, depending on the size of the lesion, to make sure the skin cancer is completely cleared and to give the patient a good cosmetic outcome.
Okay.
On the trunk, you could consider a scrape and burn. Of course, on the arms, excision, the side of the face, an excision.
So removal is not just, you're not just interested in removing the cancer, but you want to have a good cosmetic result.
As well, and you want to make sure you get a good clear margin, and that means that there's good healthy skin on either side to make sure that the recurrence rates are very low. So Mohs has, for basal cell and squamous cell, typically has about a 99% cure
really
rate.
Yeah.
Whereas an excision is about 95%, scrape and burn is less, so it goes down from there.
So what's the process with Mohs? I understand it's pretty laborious and somewhat time-consuming. Could you describe a little bit about what Mohs is and what makes it so special?
So the Mohs surgeon cuts the skin cancer out and then takes the specimen immediately himself or herself to look under the microscope. And the way that they cut the specimen, they're able to look at all the perimeter. And so not just a portion of the edge and a portion of the bottom, they're able to look completely around the edge, outer edges, and the deep margin, so that they check and make sure there's no atypical basal cells or squamous cell left there. And then they take more if they didn't get it all, and they go until they're done. And it can, those lesions, especially the complicated ones, can get, you know, really large, mm-hmm. 3, 4, 5 centimeters. And so they can get into a very complicated closure. And so they sometimes either close it themselves or they call in the plastic surgeon to help them.
So you can, in an effort to get the entire lesion and negative margins, you can end up with a defect, I imagine.
Absolutely.
Rather. And if it occurs on your nose or the lip or the ear, that could definitely, sounds like it could have some serious cosmetic impact. So are there other techniques that you might be able to use to incorporate in the treatment whereby you could preserve cosmesis or a cosmetic outcome without necessarily taking as much tissue?
So, I mean, you know, radiation oncologists do radiation to some of those lesions. There's also some new medications for really advanced basal cells, where you can take a pill by mouth. Those are typically reserved for lesions that we don't think are going to do well with surgical or radiation procedures. But there are things that you can do to preserve the cosmetic, you know, results.
Yeah, that was a shameless little gimme to promote my own specialty. But no, but I myself, as you know, we work together and we'll often treat skin cancers. And sometimes it's in that very situation where there's a cosmetic concern with aggressive surgery, and we'll treat the cancers with primary radiation, oftentimes with a very good result in terms of controlling the cancer as well as preserving a good cosmetic result. And then sometimes after surgery, there are some high risk features, whether it be positive margins, or sometimes there's nerve involvement, or some other features that could predispose somebody for having a recurrence. And then we'll follow up the surgery with radiation as well. So oftentimes it really is a team approach.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You mentioned topical creams for skin cancers. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, there's a topical cream that treats superficial basal cells called Imiquimod, or Aldera is one of the name brands. There's several other name brands, and it actually is a topical cream applied to the skin that gets the patient's immune system involved in treating the basal cell or precancer. And we also use 5-fluorouracil, which is FUDEX, a lot in precancers, which is a topical chemo cream, which kind of irritates the precancerous cell, and then it heals very nicely with a good result, so that you don't have to come in as often for the liquid nitrogen. And there are other new topicals that are out, but those two are by far the more common.
Okay. Now, what happens when the cancer, let's say, spreads, whether it be a melanoma or a squamous cell carcinoma, and it spreads to the lymph nodes? What happens then?
So on deep melanomas, you know, we generally send them to the general surgeon, and they'll do what's called a sentinel lymph node biopsy. And if the sentinel lymph nodes are positive, then they send them to the oncologist to evaluate with PET scanning and further treatment. And once the oncologist is involved, you know, there's systemic, oftentimes chemotherapy, radiation, other ways to treat those advanced melanomas or squamous cells.
Hopefully they're caught before that
exactly.
happens. Yeah. We have a caller on the line, Associate Professor Dr. Beverly Burden. Welcome to Health Matters.
Thank you. I'm an entomologist, and I do my own show there at the station, but there's something that comes up that I'm asked to consult on a regular basis, and the dermatologist knows what's going on, and I know what's going on, but I never know how they actually handle in their office delusory parasitosis.
What? Excuse me. I'm sorry.
Delusions of parasitosis. I got it.
Yeah. You have to help us out.
I know what's going on. You know what's going on, but people hardly ever talk about it. And I just never know how it's actually ever resolved in the office of the dermatologist.
So delusions of parasitosis is one of the more difficult things that we deal with. And we oftentimes, you know, have a discussion with the patient and, you know, sometimes even have to get psychiatry involved. But as you know, people believe that they have a parasite coming out of their skin and they will pick at their skin and they firmly believe that they see a bug or that there's a bug coming out of their skin. And ultimately, you know, we do a lot of in-office counseling as well as sometimes even need to get, you know, psychiatry involved. But it is a very complicated, complex problem. I appreciate you bringing it up.
Well, why do you think that oftentimes is more associated with 50-60 women, normally Caucasians?
That's a good question. A lot of times it can be associated with depression, you know, other maybe prior mental issues. So that, you know, that's a hard question to answer why it's in that demographic.
Well, that's a very interesting question. And thank you very much, Dr. Burden, for your call. I welcome other callers to call in with questions or comments they may have for our guests. And we just were joined by Dr. Ken Sanders, a facial plastic surgeon with Knight and Sanders Plastic Surgery here in Shreveport. Welcome to Health Matters.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
So we were, Dr. Glorioso and I were having a really interesting discussion about skin cancer, the causes of skin cancer, and we were just getting into the topics of how to treat skin cancer. Now, you approach skin cancer from a slightly different perspective as a surgeon. Could you first start off and share with our listeners your training and how it is that you got into treating skin cancers from a surgical perspective?
Sure. As a facial plastic surgeon, that entails moving through an ear, nose, and throat residency for anywhere from 5 to 6 years, and then doing a facial plastic surgery fellowship, which is another year after that, strictly focusing on plastic surgery of the head and neck area. So that's what I did, and we obviously treated a lot of skin cancers of the face, mostly. Nose commonly, ears, lips, and these are the ones that I typically get involved with. The more, I guess, complicated ones as far as reconstruction goes, as far as closing of a wound that may be made by removing a skin cancer.
We were just talking about that. We were talking particularly with Mohs surgery and sometimes a defect and sometimes significant defect can be left and what some of the reconstructive options are, and that's right up your alley.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that? What's some of the reconstructive things that you do?
Well, Mohs surgery, you know, obviously what they're doing is removing it and leaving quite a large wound. When I'm involved in any way, the wounds are usually larger, at least in complicated areas. And so what we do, my first line of attack is typically a local flap, which means using skin in the area. So if the wound or the little hole that's left is on the tip of the nose, I want to use skin on the nose to do the reconstruction. Typically looks better, and the final result is much more aesthetically pleasing than, say, just a skin graft. Next would be maybe a skin graft or a full thickness type of a graft, maybe from the ear or something like that. And then last would be sometimes there's not much else you can do except a split thickness skin graft. That's probably the least aesthetically pleasing, but sometimes that's what we have to do.
And what is a split thickness? What makes it different than the other types of skin graft?
full thickness skin graft, we simply measure the amount of skin we need as far as the area, and we cut down into the fat right under the skin and take all of that skin and move it to the area and sew it into the defect. A split thickness is we use a device to harvest really the epidermis or the superficial layers of the skin to just cover the wound. It usually doesn't look as good, but it does get the job done. It covers it up.
Now, what if it's involving the ear and you have to remove part of the ear? How do you reconstruct that?
Well, you know, a lot of times the ear, unfortunately, will involve cartilage to be removed. And that's complicated because of all the three-dimensional structure of the ear, all the cartilage folds that we have and the angles. You know, most times we're able to use local flap still. And in structural areas where we need to use cartilage, we can get cartilage sometimes from the other ear, believe it or not. Without leaving a defect. And then sometimes there are plastic type of implants that we can use to reconstruct the ear if it's a large defect with lots of cartilage removed.
Now, how often do you... Yes.
I was going to see if he's ever used the porcine grafts, just out of curiosity.
You know, in training I did, but yeah. Nowadays, no.
Pig tissue.
Yeah. Yeah, pig skin grafts.
Now, we were talking a little bit right before you came in about what happens when these cancers spread and become more advanced, spread to the lymph nodes and into the glands, the parotid glands and things of that sort. And that's something I imagine that you encounter not infrequently. What happens in a case like that?
Well, that's becomes more complicated than I typically will deal with. Usually I'll be calling someone like you for radiation, or even the hematologist oncologist for some of the more chemotherapy type treatments and things like that. If it's just lymph nodes, then we might refer them to a head and neck surgeon for removal of that area of lymph nodes.
I see. Okay. And how much of your practice would you say is made up of treating skin cancer, precancerous lesions, and effects of sun damage?
Probably 10 to 15%.
That's significant.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's go into a little bit of that with the sun damage. What are some of the procedures and the products available, Dr. Glorioso, to help repair sun-damaged skin and make it look better?
So there's a lot of products out there on the market. Of course, sunscreen is the number one anti-aging cream out there. In addition to that, there's a lot of topical antioxidants that can help protect the skin as well as help reverse some of the signs of aging. All dermatologists love, and I'm sure plastic surgeons love, retinoids. So that's like retinol or Retin-A, which actually over time has shown to can have some chemo prevention, so that people who use Retin-A nightly will have less actinic keratoses. That helps build collagen. It helps turn over the skin cells more quickly. Of course, using moisturizers. There's other things you can add to your skincare routine, such as collagen stimulators, growth factors, and then there's procedures that I know Dr. Sanders and I both can do, such as chemical peels, microdermabrasions, lasers. So, I mean, the list goes on and on. And the cosmetic market to help sun-damaged skin is just the sky's the limit these days.
It's huge.
Yeah.
Okay, so anti-aging creams that you see advertised on television, do they work? What's the basis for them? Either one of you. I'll take whoever wants to grab that one.
I would say typically the anti-aging creams you see advertised on television probably do not work or won't do very much. Most of the things that I know about anyway are going to contain very small amounts of active ingredients or an inactive form of a very good ingredient that we use all the time, but it's not a very stable form, I'll say. So typically the department store things, the drugstore things, the on TV things are just, they smell good, they feel good, they just don't do a lot of good. We're now, I think, in the field of skincare almost to the point where the word cosmeceutical is realistic nowadays. You know, it's a cosmetic treatment, but it's really like a pharmaceutical. And most of the things that Dr. Glorioso provides and I provide to patients If they weren't provided in our offices, they would be prescription.
I see. So these are things that, people can only get from the doctor's office, effectively, that they can't get over the counter or through the internet or,
right.
on TV.
Right.
So they're effectively like medicine.
Very much so. I mean, these things are studied. I've been to several of the symposiums put on by different companies, and their scientists, their skin biologists and chemists are really hard at work on this stuff and present it to us as if they're presenting a new drug. They have formulated specific ingredients to attack a problem, say for brown spots. Okay, we want to minimize brown spots. Well, in the past, we had really one option, and it was an okay option. Now there's multiple options, and these guys, these chemists and biologists have worked and figured out all of the pathways that cause brown to appear in our skin and then how to combat that. So they really have parsed it down into developing a medication.
I see. So if they're basically effectively prescription or prescription strength type agents, does that mean that there are potential side effects associated with them as well, and that they need to be used in a controlled fashion?
Sure. Yeah. Most of everyone that we see in consultation for that type of thing is really, you know, put through the rigors of describing what to do, how to apply this, when to apply it, what to look for.
Okay.
Especially looking out for things like pregnancy, you know, there's things that you don't want to use if you're pregnant or breastfeeding, things like that. So you definitely want to consult a doctor before you go to a Canada pharmacy and just buy some anti-aging cream.
Makes sense. Okay. We have Zach back. We're going to try this again. Zach, welcome to Health Matters.
Hey.
Oh, perfect. Thanks for being persistent.
Sorry about that.
And what is your question for the doctors?
I try to take, you know, good care of myself, and I'm having trouble with back acne and, you know, forehead acne, and I'm trying to figure out a way to ensure that I would have a healthier skin. Do you guys have any advice, maybe nutritional advice? Is there a routine that I could develop to kind of ensure that I would have the best skin that I...
So, for... diet and acne, there has been some research that's come. We used to say, you know, it's probably not your diet that's causing your acne. However, you know, a good diet with antioxidants, a lot of water, of course, is better. The healthier you are, the better your skin's going to look. We say high dairy or high glycemic index diets are probably not good, as good for your skin as a higher protein, higher antioxidant diet. Now, other things that you can do, what we generally say, though, is if you know a food that flares your acne, try to avoid it. Now, other things you can do just available over the counter, there's many benzoyl peroxide type washes, salicylic acid type washes. You can do those things without having a physician involved, and you can clean your skin, you know, in the shower with one of those cleansers, especially after you exercise, get the sweaty clothes off. Those are things that you can do on your own. And then when it gets to the point where you have cystic acne or lesions that could potentially scar, you don't want to hesitate in, you know, seeking a physician. So that way, you know, you don't have any long-term sequela from your acne. And then we can get oral antibiotics, topicals, and even Accutane is still available in severe cases.
Thank you very much, Zach, for your question. You know, ironically, when I was a child, I suffered from acne, and I found that sun exposure was very helpful. But now I'm going to have some screening. Yes, Dr. Sanders.
Dr. Gloria, so I heard this recently that a lot of adult acne or people that complain of, you know, all of a sudden I'm getting pimples again is really not acne necessarily, but more of a skin infection. What are you seeing that much?
There's
more?
A lot of folliculitis, skin infection. So staph, of course, and strep, but staph more commonly. But a lot of the adult acne, especially in men, we're seeing there's a lot of testosterone supplementation these days, and a lot of things that aren't, you know. And we're seeing a lot of male chest and back acne as gentlemen get older because they're on a lot of testosterone. And of course, women with hormonal induced acne typically is like this lower face chin cystic acne, but there's a major surge in you know, back and chest and men because of testosterone supplements.
Excuse me. You mentioned some of the other things, chemical peels and microdermabrasion for sun-damaged skin. Do either of you offer this in your practice?
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so chemical peels have been around a long time, and there's a variety of peeling agents such as glycolic acid, salicylic acid, trichloroacetic acid. And typically, you know, it takes a series of chemical peels to get rid of hyperpigmentation or melasma. We can even use trichloroacetic acid, that's a TCA peel, to treat precancers such as actinic keratosis. So I still love chemical peels. There's a lot of we do a lot of lasers, but chemical peels are wonderful. There's not one-stop shopping with any of this. It's going to take a series. It's going to take maintenance. You can't just come in for one chemical peel and think your skin is going to look perfect. And you also need to be doing good topicals at home. So this is a combination approach.
I see. Now, Dr. Sanders, what about with all these lasers that are available now, is there still a role for chemical peels, or what's the advantage to the lasers or disadvantage versus the chemical peels?
So much like Dr. Glorioso said, the chemical peel definitely has its role. In my practice, I use the chemical peels mostly for the light resurfacing or the very mild resurfacing, stuff that is not, we're not trying to really affect a major change in the skin, very little downtime, but some noticeable effects. I kind of use the analogy, this is almost like having your car detailed. There is some lasting effect, but it's not permanent, and in a month or two you need to do it again. Now, the more aggressive lasers that we both do, I'm pretty sure she does a similar type of deeper resurfacing. I used to do chemical peels for this as well before the lasers became so good at it. We had lasers years ago, but they were very fraught with complications and difficulties in treatment. And nowadays, it's much simpler. And in my hands, I just feel like the laser is much more precise than a deep chemical peel. With the deep chemical peels, it's very dependent on how wet your Q-tip is or how much pressure you're rubbing with the Q-tip. The laser, I set it for a certain depth, and that's it, every single pulse. So for deep chemical peeling or deep resurfacing, I tend to always go with laser nowadays.
Now, if you have the spider veins or telangiectasias on your face, the chemical peels, will they address that, or is that something that the laser is uniquely suited for?
Chemical peels is not for vascular treatment. Lasers and not even a resurfacing laser, a completely different wavelength of laser is used for telangiectasias or the little small spider veins or strawberry spots or cherry spots or any of these little red things that we get on our face or the little blood vessels around the nose. Those are all very easily treated with a laser.
Okay, we have another caller on the line. This is Donna from Natchez. Donna, welcome to Health Matters.
I have a quick question. I need to know, what's the most current treatment for unwanted facial hair in women?
Laser procedure is now the gold standard for unwanted facial hair in women and men for that matter. There are creams that help some, like a Vanica cream can help some. Electrolysis is still used, but by far and away, laser hair removal is now the gold standard.
And does that prevent any regrowth?
We never say it's 100% permanent, but the lasers are very good, and with a series of sessions, it can remove the hair very effectively. And you may need a touch-up every, year or so after you've completed your original series. But we hate to ever use the word 100% permanent in medicine.
Thank you very much, Donna, for your question. Getting back to the resurfacing, what about injectables? Fillers and Botox and things of that sort. Dr. Sanders, what role do they play in repairing sun-damaged skin?
Well, the fillers and Botox, as far as sun damage goes, usually the surface of the skin is what we say is damaged by the sun. Now, in the severely damaged skin, of course, you get their very deep wrinkles or lines, and that's where fillers or Botox can come in. The fillers and Botox will be considered more an anti-aging rather than just a skin sun damage. Botox is simply a muscle relaxer. It's going to relax the muscle that we inject it with. It gets absorbed into the muscle and causes the muscle not to be able to contract as strongly. And if it's placed appropriately and in the right doses, it does a great job. We both have seen people overtreated and undertreated, and people that think Botox is not doing its job or doesn't work for them. And frankly, I think we both would agree that it's technique dependent. And if it's not placed appropriately, then the result is not going to be effective. Fillers, there's lots of different fillers. Those are not going to relax muscles. They're simply going to fill an area. Now, we have superficial fillers and we have deep fillers, and so they do different things. The superficial fillers are more for filling in lines, creases. The deeper fillers are more for the volumization of the face and recreating youth with volume, because as we age, of course, we lose volume in the face.
So this is more anti-aging than it is related to the sun, per se?
Yes.
Now, what about things like brown spots or melasma, hyperpigmentation or pigmented changes? Those are sometimes caused by the sun, but not necessarily. But are those things that you use the laser for? Is that correct?
Right. So you can take care of like a solar lentigo that's a brown sunspot with a laser. You can also use liquid nitrogen. Melasma, which is typically hormonal in women, that's the hyperpigmentation, it can be caused by pregnancy, birth control, or just by being a female. You know, you can use lasers, you can use chemical peels, you can use good topicals. Again, there's a wide, and that typically is all at some point linked back to the sun. And there's multiple ways to treat all of those sun-related skin diseases.
Now, we're talking about, you know, in addition to the sun damage, we're also talking a little bit about some of the things that can be done to help the skin look more youthful for whatever the reason. What are some things people can do to help keep their skin looking youthful, like in terms of lifestyle, whether it be you hear things about people should drink water or certain diets that they should follow, or maybe, you know, alcohol or smoking? Is there anything that that you recommend to your patients in terms of how to keep their skin looking nice from just things that they can do as part of their lifestyle?
So there's five major factors for facial aging. There's the sun, which we can control. There's smoking, which we can control. And then the other three are time, genetics, and gravity. We can't really control the other three. So you need to take control of the two you really can. And I agree with Dr. Glorio. So sunscreen is the number one. If you're going to do one single thing for your skin, wear a sunscreen every day. I do. I'm sure she does. And you know, it's highly recommended, not only for preventing skin cancers, but for just the anti-aging effect. And then, of course, smoking wreaks havoc on your skin. It preferentially starves the skin of oxygen. And we've all seen the pictures of a smoker twin and a non-smoker twin and how much older the smoker twin looks. So those two things, smoking and sunscreen, are, in my book, number one and two.
And then what about, you also mentioned taking care of your skin with a skin regimen, I mm-hmm. think you used the term earlier, Dr. Galeo. So what sort of things should people be using in terms of, you know, at home, in terms of soaps and washes and moisturizers that they can use at home?
So a good, you know, gentle cleanser should be used. As well as you can exfoliate with an exfoliating cleanser a few times a week. You don't want to over exfoliate your skin. So that's as far as skin cleansing. Again, a good antioxidant we recommend, a good sunscreen we recommend, a good moisturizer we recommend. Of course, like I mentioned, a retinol or retinoid can be used in the evening. You want to make sure that's part of your evening routine.
And that's so over the counter. You can get
retinol over the counter. But the type that he kind of mentioned that we have at our offices that are going to soak in and you're going to get really good penetration. Our prescription strength are sold at physicians' offices. So moisturizing the skin, making sure it's not too dry, because dry cracked skin looks more aged than kind of a moist, supple appearance. So there's things that you can get at the drugstore that will help if you don't have the ability to afford some of the more expensive things, especially again sunscreen, cleansing, moisturizers, those sorts of things.
Very good.
I think one other thing about sunscreen. I think one of the most misunderstood things about sunscreen is people put it on in the morning. They'll buy an over-the-counter, you know, sunscreen, which most are very good sunscreens. However, they're only going to work about 90 minutes. So if you put it on at 8 o'clock in the morning and you think you're protected through 5 o'clock in the afternoon, you are not. You have a sunscreen that is effective for about 90 minutes. And the problem is most women are not going to reapply a liquid sunscreen in the middle of the day.
So even if you're not sweating and you're not doing any athletics
the sunscreen molecule, it's a chemical reaction between the UV ray and the sunscreen molecule. And so that molecule gets used up. Even though there might still be a greasiness of the cream still in the skin, the molecule that's actually protective is gone. So what we recommend is there are powder sunscreens now, especially popular with women because they can throw this little powder brush in their purse and reapply a 50 SPF sunscreen in the middle of the day as many times as they like.
Hmm.
Very effective.
Now, we were talking a little bit earlier about, for those of us who look ridiculous in hats, is there any, you know, I'm always looking for like a sunscreen shampoo or styling gel or something because I just don't look good in hats and that's an area where I burn. Do you know of any such product? And if not, you know, perhaps you guys can offer it in your office.
I typically recommend the sprays for the gentlemen who are, you know, that don't want to reapply the cream to their head. Again, those sunscreen sticks.
There are sunscreen sprays for your head?
Well, not specific, you know, just the ones that you can do on your body. But if you have a thinning scalp, you know, you can use that. You can rub in the cream. They have the sticks. Again, the powder that Dr. Sanders mentioned. I'm not aware of a sunscreen shampoo.
Okay, so that's what we need to do. Both of you, after we're done here, can get to work on that. I think you've got a real market here. Well, I want to thank, we've run out of time. This has been a really informative topic, and I'm so glad you were both here to share your knowledge with me and with our listeners. I certainly learned a lot. So again, Dr. Sanders from Dr. Knight and Sanders Plastic Surgery and Dr. Sara Glorioso from Arc Latex Dermatology. Thanks again for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. Consult your physician or healthcare provider for all health concerns. Guests on Health Matters are not compensated and are selected by relevance to the topic. No fees are charged for participation in Health Matters. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran, with assistance provided this evening by Wally Derleth and Tim Snell. Production of Health Matters is made possible in part by the Noel Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and also by the Gables at Spring Lake, Gamble Guest Care's assisted living community, located behind Spring Lake Guest Care Center on Line Avenue in Shreveport. Learn more at gambleguestcare.com. I'm Dr. Sanford Katz. Thank you for joining us this evening.